Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.
And welcome to the Writer's Block on LA Talk Radio. I am your host for this evening, Richard Polinelli, and I think this is a show, you know, we never wanted to do. But for those of you who don't already know, this past Sunday morning, our longtime host, Jim Christina, passed away in his home in Idaho. And we are all pretty much still in a little bit of shock. But we have decided that we will gather this last time before the show goes into a hiatus, and we will pay tribute to our friend and to this show that he created. So to start, before I introduce who all is with us this evening, his wife and the person who is the engine of this show that we lovingly call the bookie, Jerry Christina, has asked me to read this. And I will make no promises. But here we go. I would like to thank all the wonderful writers and friends that have sent thoughts and prayers for my husband, Jim. In lieu of a memorial, we are going to celebrate Jim's life right here on Facebook. His memorial is Facebook, where he connected with friends, family, and authors. He loved the written word, books, lyrics, and music. He loved the writer's block and all the wonderful authors that he interviewed. He would sit in front of his computer on show night, headphones placed just right, and let his booming voice rip the airwaves, all while his glass of Crown Royal sat next to him. All of your wonderful, heartfelt comments and condolences he would love, for after all, they are a part of the word spoken or written. He was talented, smart, and downright fun. So we celebrate him here and now, and thank you, friends, for 7 years of fun, information, and love. It is fitting to close out the light of Jim's life with this memorial to him and to the other light of his life, the Writer's Block Radio Show. Thank you all. He would love all the wonderful things you have posted in his honor. From the bottom of my heart, I thank everyone for your love and kindness through the years. And we end with one of his favorite sayings. May your glass be ever full. May the roof over your head be always strong, and may you be in heaven half an hour before the devil knows you're dead. And that sums up Jim. And I will make no apologies for the fact that I'm going to struggle tonight, but we are joined by the co-hosts of this show, Bobby Jean Bell, Russ Avison, Bob Brill, and our regularly scheduled guest, J.R. Sanders, is joining us. He's a returning guest and a friend of Jim's, and he was supposed to be on to talk about his book. We will get to that later, but he also will be here to share some of the memories of our friend and our co-host. So I'm going to go grab my crying towel, and I'm going to turn this over to Bobby. Bobby, you have been with the show since the beginning. I was listening to the first show, I think first or second show, and Jim said it took you guys about a year and a half to get it launched. So what I want to do is ask each of you your memories of your first meeting with Jim and your first memories of this show. And we're going to start with Bobby, because you're going to be the ones going to tell us how this all got started.
Oh, it's been a week of tears and looking at a lot of photographs that I have taken over the years. My husband, another Jim, and I have known Jim and Jerry since a phone call in 2009. And so we have a lot of history together. It's a long story, and I don't want to take up everybody else's time. I will tell you, we all know that voice. And one day I picked up the phone in 2009. Our Buckaroo Bookshop had already happened for that year, just by a short time. And I picked up the phone and I said, "This is Bobby Bell at West Shop. What can I do for you?" And this voice said, do you book authors for events?" And I said, "We do." I said, "Who am I talking to?" And he introduced himself. And that became the first step in a really long history together. He did join us for the Buckaroo Bookshop. I was going back through, I think, 7 years out of the 10 that we did it. And he missed the first one, obviously. He was part of our referral panel of authors that we had in our store. He was with us when we did a big celebration to open the Old Town New Hall Library. Every time he published a new book, two books in particular, he was with me on another radio show where I got my feet wet and felt that I fell in love with radio. Around the Barn, he was with us right after publishing Contraband Cowboys and the second Bugles in the Sun. And then we were chatting one day. He asked me to write a foreword for a book. Many of you have done the same. That was stunning that he would ask me to do that. And I did that for The Dark Angel. And then one day he called me and he said, "I'm thinking about something and I'd love you to come along aboard with me." I said, "What are you thinking about, Jim?" Because usually it was about a book or an idea that he had. "Well, I just loved being on Around the Barn. And ever since the last time I was on that, I thought, I want my own radio show. I want to share the process that writers go through with new writers. I want to have this platform and I want it every week. And I'd like you to come alongside of me and be with me through it." Today marks 350 shows. Mm-hmm. We all made a commitment. We read the book every week. So 350 books. I looked forward to every book that came my way. I looked forward to tonight every week. And Jim, I will really miss you. And thank you for inviting me to come along.
Yeah, I think we all echo that. I meant to mention at the beginning and Jerry's note kind of torpedoed that. This is the last show, but Jim opened it. The guitar music that you heard, both guitars, were Jim. And it was from the song Something That Is Right. His band, Sundown, back in, I believe, the 80s, late 80s, early 90s, recorded that. And we just felt it was the right way to open the show is have Jim open it, even though he's not here to open it. Bobby, you were with the first show on May 21st, 2015. The very next week, somebody wandered into the studio named Russ Abison. So we're going to bring on Russ. And Russ, tell us about how you wound up being a part of this and how you met Jim.
Well, it kind of goes back to, actually, it's very interesting, but I met Jim's daughter, Maggie, before I ever met Jim. Mm-hmm. And as you know, I'm a dog trainer, and Maggie was interested in dog training. And so she looked me up and we connected and had a lunch, I think, one time. And then later on, when Jim got his dog, Bella, Maggie said, "You know, I'm going to put you in touch with my dad because I think you could help him out." And so we actually met because he came to a dog training class. Well, we did the training with Bella and he came through all his classes. And that's, by the way, that's a really soft side of Jim that a lot of people may not know because, you know, Jim, he comes across sometimes gruff, but I'll tell you, he loved Bella. Like every time I call, he'd go, "You know, Bella, Uncle Russ is on the phone." He'd get Bella to come over and bark on the phone. Yeah, it was great. But he loved that dog. And anyway, then I was doing a show called Atomic Dog Radio that had done for about 5 years. And Jim, being an author and having this dog that I had worked on training, we talked about training. So we said, "Let's have Jim on the show." So he came and did a show with us. And my co-host on that show is Jillian Boyd. We did the show. And Jim started listening to our show a lot, and he noticed that we had authors on a lot. And I'm not a writer. All the rest of you are writers.
Me too.
Yeah. And oh, well, okay.
You and me, Russ.
There we go. But he liked the fact that because I'm not a writer, I ask questions that the writers don't ask. I ask because I read books and I have a different perspective, I guess. So he asked me if, because Bobby Jean, I think you had it one Thursday a month that you couldn't do the show.
Right.
And so Jim asked me if I'd like to come on and be the guest co-host. And I said to him, what do you want me for? I'm a dog trainer. You're talking about writing and having authors and playwrights. And he said, no, you have a different perspective. And I've heard you interview all these authors on your show. And so that's how we ended up doing the show. And I think I was there probably the second month, maybe, that you started.
The second show.
I think of you as being there, like even show one. When we have a picture of you with Courtney, I mean, I'm thinking that you were actually there on show
maybe
one.
Maybe I was.
But in any case.
I'm getting old. I don't remember.
You asked wonderful questions.
Aw, thanks. And I do want to point out two things. I know that the people listening can't see it, but we're all on a Skype call and we can all see each other. And the background that I have is the Sespe Creek, which is right behind my ranch here. And Jim loved the Sespe Creek. And he, when he was younger and he was working with horses, they used to ride down in the Sespe Creek. Mm-hmm. So I put that. And also, he always had his Crown Royal next to him. Well, I decided this is a glass of Bailey's Irish Cream because I don't drink the straight stuff. But I wanted to have that here tonight just to toast to Jim.
Yep, so, definitely.
Anyway, that's our story.
Bob, you came on the first mention I can find of you in the archives, and if it's earlier, let me know. But you came on shortly after I had left to go to Nebraska for God only knows why. But why don't
we've
you
all asked
us,
that many times?
Yeah, I know. It's just sometimes you just go astray. I know you knew Jim before you came on the show, so why don't you talk to us about when you met Jim and how you got roped into coming onto the show and being a co-host.
Well, originally I met Bobby because, as you know, I worked at KNX News Radio in LA, and I still do. And I wanted to cover the event, the Santa Clarita Cowboy Festival. And I came out, and I was an author as well. And Bobby and I got to talk, and she gave me the grand tour, and I forget what year that was. And eventually, I think it was the next year, I decided, okay, I'm going to do this. And wrote my first Western novel for that show. And my idea was to write one for each new year. And Jim was there, and along with Eric Eisner and Al Bringus and some of the other folks, and Andrea Kidd, and kind of blended in with everybody. Changed hats over the course of time because people would make fun of the fact that I wasn't wearing a cowboy hat because I felt I wasn't a cowboy. I just wrote about it. And so my fondest memory of was just a few years ago and show the kind of character Jim was. Some of you may remember that Johnny Boggs was
there. Yes.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Was there, and we're always going back and forth. And somebody said that they thought Johnny Boggs was some other person. I think it was an actor, and I don't remember who it was.
Stephen King.
Yes, Stephen King. I was,
oh yeah, J.R. and I talked about this the other night. So carry on.
J.R. will remember this. Johnny
was Stephen King. And so at the end of the day, Johnny was gone early, and Jim and I were talking, and Jim said, I'm going to really do this up tomorrow. And he paid some kid, gave him like $5, to come in and go up to Johnny and say, you're Stephen King. Said, no, you're Stephen King. I know you are. And this kid, he must have been 12, I think. And we're also, and I was recording it, and I know several other people were too. And we're all, and Johnny's just kind of getting kind of stewed on the game, And sure enough, Jim fesses up, and he put the kid up to it, and the place just busted up all over. So funny, but that's the kind of guy Jim was, And he can kind of, like Russ said, he can be kind of gruff, but at the same time, in his gruffness, he could concoct this really funny thing and carry it off. Yeah. And I always loved that about it. And I love that type of stuff myself. And I just loved him about it. And at some point, I don't remember when, I think you mentioned when you were getting ready to go to Nebraska. Jim asked me, because he knew my background in radio, he said, I'd like you to come on and maybe guest host once in a while. And I said, yeah, sure. So, you know, and it was Thursday night. It was not far from where I live. And so I would go down and I told Jim kind of up front and that I'm not going to read the book every week. You know, I don't have time. I can't do it. No, but I'm not going to do it. And he says, yeah, I said, I'll ask questions that, you know, kind of appeal to me. I've always felt that I ask questions that the listener wanted to ask, no matter what they were. So I would ask more about the process and stuff. And then the one time I made sure that I brought a bottle of almond tequila.
Almond tequila.
And Jerry supposed to. There's a tequila factory in Puerto Vallarta. And they won't ship it to the U.S. They'll ship it to TJ, and I'm not going to TJ to pick it up. So we have to take a cruise to go down there. And then they brought a case to the ship the last time. And they'll do that. Yeah, I'll buy it. They'll bring a case of six bottles to the ship. And it's the most wonderful tequila you've ever wanted to taste it. And I haven't been able to find it anywhere else. And you guys have all tasted it. And I would just, you know, I'd bring a flask, and I'd pour you guys a shot, you know. And Jim would say, I'm ready for more. Jerry and every time I think I talked to him on the phone, he'd say, Jerry has one question for you. When am I getting my almond tequila? And I haven't been able to go down there to do that. And I still wore a bottle, but he would always bug me about that. And the other thing, he always would answer the phone when he knew it was me. It was Bob Brill. KNX News Radio. I'm listening to it. I write you my name. Yeah. And it was like, okay, I'm listening in stereo, right? But, you know, it was so fun. And I think, and I posted this on Facebook that, you know, I loved him, you know, and I've had three mentors in my life, and I consider him one of them, and mainly regarding the books. The last book I wrote that he published, actually, which was The Tattoo Murder. Mm-hmm. And when he told me how much he liked it and how much he loved it, and you got to write a sequel. And I said, okay, I'm going to write a sequel. I know what it's going to be about. And now that, you know, his passing guarantees one thing. Now I made that commitment, and I have to write the sequel because it's going to be dedicated to Jim. And, you know, it was such a shock this week. Like everybody has mentioned, when Russ let me know that it had happened, and I called Jerry later in the day, and she still hadn't, you know, comprehended it. It was just a few hours later, and I mean, we are missing not only the great character. And he was, and everything about Jim was just cool. And I mean, the softness, the hardness, the knowledge that he had. We did a panel together, a virtual panel a couple of years ago, because it was during the pandemic. And I kept having to refer the questions regarding Western history to him, because I knew he knew more than I did about that particular part of the subject. And I was like, I'm not going to answer this question knowing he knows 10 times more than I know, you know, and I'm not going to be really embarrassed by that. I'll answer what I could answer. And then if he picks it up, go for it, Jim, go for it, you know, and he did. And it was just great.
You know, to add to the story about the kid, Jim was setting this up for a couple hours that morning. And the way he got the kid, there's a couple with I think he was 10, 12 years old. So he called, he goes, sir, come here. So the family comes up for our table. He goes, I want to buy your kid for a couple of minutes. I'm like, dude, that's not the least bit creepy. But, you know, and they went right along with it, not knowing until he finally got around to telling what we were up to. But I mean, he could do that, you know. JR, you were there for the infamous I'm Not Stephen King shenanigans. You were on the show for the first time back in June of 2015. You've been on a couple of times, and I know you and Jim were good friends. So, you know, tell us how you met him and how he got you to come on the show.
I met Jim at one of those book signings at Bobby and Jim's store, and it may have been the same one that was Jim's first one. I don't really remember. It was around about 2008, 2010. And we were all sitting at rows of tables in there, and Jim sat directly behind me. It's the first time I'd met him. You know, he introduced himself, and we shook hands, and we chatted, and we ended up pretty much talking the whole time. And I'm not a big small talk guy, but Jim was, so, you know, I just kind of kicked back and let him carry the conversation, and he was happy to do that. But he was just such an interesting guy, had such varied interests. You know, we talked about dogs, we talked about the Old West, we talked about horses, writing, of course. And the thing that really struck me and that stuck with me about Jim was how passionate he was about his writing. You know, how he would just kind of light up when he was telling you what he was working on. He would tell you about his books, kind of run the stories down for you. But he was also interested in everybody else in the room. He was sincerely interested in, hey, what are you writing? What are you working on? You know, what have you done? I just found that kind of refreshing. You know, writers tend to be kind of solitary animals. And it was just neat to meet somebody that was that outgoing and that gregarious and that just sincerely interested in other people and other perspectives and, you know, other people's work.
Yeah. Yeah, my first encounter with Jim was my first encounter with this show. And it was back in April of 2016. I had written my book and my agent had arranged for me to be on the show shortly after it came out. And at the time, I was living up in the Bay Area. And yes, this is the Richard Polinelli Traveling Roadshow. You never know where I'm going to wind up from year to year. But I was up in the Bay Area when we were scheduled. But by the time I got on, because the show was popular and it was booked in advance, I had moved down to Simi Valley. And ironically enough, I think I could have one hopped a three iron from my front door to Jim's. So I said, you know, I'd like to come in. I've never done an in-person radio show before. And not knowing what to expect, I showed up and Russ and Jim were there. I think I beat you guys there because I'm crazy that way. I show up an hour early. I don't know why. But we were there and it struck me how relaxing the show was. You know, the first radio show I did was over the phone and I was all tensed up and worried. And you could tell the people hadn't read the book. They just read the blurb. They had no idea. I'm struggling to pitch the book. Get on this show and it just, I mean, we started and then instantly the show's over. It's 50 minutes have gone by. It was a great, great show. So yeah, over time, Jim, I think he called me a few months later, a guest had bailed at the last minute. He goes, so are you working on anything? And I'm like, well, dude, I'm always doing something. So off we go. And eventually it led to, I think Bobby was going to miss. And he goes, well, you doing anything tonight? And I went, well, I think I was going to watch the football game. He goes, no, you're not. You're coming to do and you're going to be co-hosting the show. And I'm like, okay. You know, and it led to me being a regular host. And I went through this week and started downloading the shows I was on. And I was expecting 30, you know, between guests and host, 70. This is the 70th time I've been on the show.
Wow.
And it doesn't feel like 70. And it's because of Jim. It's just the way he made you feel as an author. He read the book. He cared about what he read. And he was there to help you tell the world about this book he read. And it didn't matter what kind of book it was. And to me, that I will always appreciate that about him. You know, over time we wrote a book together and then for some crazy reason, we're driving into the show one night and he goes, so you've got your own printing name, right? And I went, yeah, Tuscany Bay Publishing. He goes, well, I got Black Dog Publishing. And I go, okay. And he goes, what do you say we combine them? I'm like, where did that come from? And he goes, no, we put them together. We'll come up with a name and we'll not only be doing our books, but we're going to reach out to authors who maybe can't get published traditionally or don't want to do the traditional route. They want to do a slightly different route. Let's offer them an avenue to come. And that gave birth to Tuscany Bay Books. And you know, if you had asked me the first night I walked into the studio, if this I would be here, and the 6 years that have transpired, I would have thought you were nuts. But it has been an incredible journey with him. And I think we all can say that. And I think we're all going to miss these conversations on Thursday night. I said this on Facebook, and before I kind of switch, throw it to JR, because we're going to talk about your book. It is probably one of the greatest blessings of my life that I have walked the earth with someone like Jim Christina. And I think you all would agree with that.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yes. Okay. Let's kind of change gears here, because JR, you did write a book called Dead Bang Fall. And I want to tell you, I am disappointed to find out it's not about a mortician who set up shop next to a cat house and a waterfall. All right. False advertising here, my friend. Why don't you tell us about your book? And I know Bobby's probably the only one who has read it all the way through. So I'm going to let her kind of ask you a couple of questions about it for a few minutes here.
Well, it's the second book in a series about Nate Voss, who's a private investigator in Los Angeles in the late 1930s. And in this book, we find out a little bit more. The first book deals somewhat with his background when he was a former deputy sheriff, Los Angeles County deputy sheriff. And he left that job under a little bit of a cloud. He ended up testifying against some fellow officers who were doing a bunch of stuff they shouldn't have been doing. And as a result, he's pretty much hated by every cop in Los Angeles, whether LAPD, the sheriff's department. He's kind of a pariah. In the second book, we find out a little bit more about that background and exactly what happened. But the main story is, it starts with a murder, as, you know, all good mysteries do. Nate almost witnesses a murder. And shortly afterward, he's visited by one of the cops he sent to prison 5 years earlier, who had been a friend of his before all this happened. And this guy is the main suspect in the murder that Nate has almost witnessed. But he comes to Nate with kind of an odd proposal under the circumstances. He wants Nate to help him prove that he didn't do it. Nate's reluctant, of course. He's got no love for this guy. But he becomes convinced that in this case, this guy's telling the truth. He didn't do it. And so it becomes sort of his mission to find out who did and why. and of course, it escalates from there with more murders. And,
JR, I really enjoyed this book, the second in the series, the Nate Ross series. And once again, you have chosen Los Angeles as the home base. And you have us the first book was 1938, and you have us in 1939 with some going back 5 years a little bit. And every now and then I had to remember, oh, I'm in 1934 now. One of the things that's so fun about reading you is how your descriptions let us know where we are, and the vocabulary that's used. And I had been making a list of some of the probably very popular words of the time that sound sort of archaic, but make the book just feel like we have stepped back. What kind of research do you have to do to make sure that you're staying current with that, you know, you're right in that time period, but it's not stilted or docudrama, you know? What do you have to do?
Yeah, a lot of it was reading old newspaper accounts and court cases, testimony from back in that period. And a lot of those words, you know, would sneak their way into that, those sort of documents. And there are some good reference books. Actually, one that was written by a lieutenant at the Sheriff's Department, the LA County Sheriff's Department, back in the 40s, where he details a lot of this lingo that was used by street gangs and hoodlums and in prison.
I know Jim was a car guy. He was cars were spoke to him just like Western movies and a lot of the other things we were talking about. And I think it was really fun that you help us identify the time period, because you've got like we have a Studebaker and we have a black Dodge coupe and a Hispano Suiza Roadster Blue.
Which is a car. If you Google Hispano Suiza Roadster 39, beautiful car.
Beautiful car. I was a docent for a short time at the Peterson Automotive Museum, and oh my goodness, those cars really speak to me. So there was a lot of really fun ways that you introduce these elements of that time period. I like Nate. He's a neat guy, and he has a way with the ladies, but it's he's a gentleman, you know. Tell us a little bit about, he's got some gals that are sort of his gal Fridays about around town. Tell us a little bit about those women.
Yeah, you know, Nate's kind of old school when it comes to women. He is, you know, a gentleman, even though he's kind of a rough around the edges guy. He's definitely got his own sense of morality. Well, the women, let's see. Start with Aggie in the latest book, Underwood, who is actually an actual person. She actually did the job that she does in Dead Bang Fall. She was a reporter and later an editor for the Herald. I believe the first woman to be the city editor of a major newspaper, at least in LA and I think in the country. And she had quite a career in her own right. She was a real central figure in the Black Dahlia case. Some people credit her, I don't think it's accurate, but some people credit her with coming up with the moniker Black Dahlia for the case. But she was an interesting person, so it was fun to drop her into the book and work her in sort of an organic way.
Gentlemen, I didn't really realize that I actually am the only lady in this panel here tonight. You all know how to speak with an author about process. Why don't we move into some process questions? Because it doesn't matter whether you've read the book or not. Truly, you're speaking with a wonderful author. So I'm going to turn it over to the three of you to get into JR's process.
Go ahead. I'm sorry. Okay. In dealing with LAPD and even LA County Sheriff's Department back at that time, obviously you had to deal with a lot of racism as well. I'm kind of wondering, because I'm having a little issue with the thing I'm working on right now too. Did you walk a fine line in dealing with not only the racism, but the attitudes of the time within the law enforcement agencies there, and how did you deal with it?
Well, it's really the elephant in the room, you know, when you're dealing with that period, especially because, as you say, there was a lot of racism, there was a lot of corruption in both departments back in the 30s. And so my idea in dealing with that aspect was just head on, you know, gloves off, and I don't really dwell on it. In the areas where it's not necessarily germane to the story I'm telling, but I don't shy away from it either. You know, it is definitely a part of the whole scene back then. And
I think
an honest job if I didn't acknowledge that.
Some of the things I'm dealing with, a couple of things that I'm working on now, is, you know, the political correctness of today. Yeah. And working from an historical standpoint that isn't dealing with, you know, things like lynchings and stuff that are right out in front that we all know about, but some of the underlying things that dealt with, you mentioned the language of the time as well, And that's where I was kind of curious. Did you have second thoughts about when you went to write something, making it more politically correct for today, or did you just jump right in and lay it out there?
I kind of just jumped right in and laid it out there. You know, I tried to do it with a delicate touch. I'm dealing with 1938, and so I thought, you know, the honest thing to do was to portray 1938 the way that it was, and the attitudes the way that they were, and not to try to gloss over any of that, not to emphasize it too much either. And I try to show a balanced view when it comes to that sort of thing. The corruption, for instance, you know, I tried to show through both books, I think, that, yeah, there was corruption in the police department, there was corruption in the sheriff's department, but on the other hand, there were these honest guys who were trying to do a good job and trying to do what was right and fighting against the corruption, which is actually, you know, what started kind of Nate on his journey as a private investigator.
Russ, I think you had a question you want to toss in there.
Yeah, mine is really a simple question, but it's always been, I've always had this curiosity. How do you come up with the names of your characters? Like your protagonist is Nate Ross.
Yeah.
Where do these names come from? I always wondered that.
That's a tricky one because sometimes they just come. I have a list in one of my notebooks of interesting names that I come across, you know, people that I meet, names that I read in, you know, say a newspaper article or here on television, or people that I went to school with 50 years ago. And I think a lot of writers do a similar thing, you know, you keep track of these interesting names. And you just sort of go through them when you're coming up with a character and try to pick a name that seems to go with that character. With Nate Ross, I kind of like the rhythm of the name, you know, the one syllable first name, one syllable last name. I don't know, for some reason that just sort of clicked in my head.
So if you pick up a name like from a, say, an old school buddy or something, and you make them the murderer, do you think you've ever ruined anybody's lives?
Like they say, the names are changed to protect the innocent. So I might use a surname, but I wouldn't use, you know, the first name to go with it. And I would change the physical description. And I will neither confirm nor deny that anybody in the books is based on anybody I've ever actually known.
Yeah. You know, or doing something like somebody you greatly disliked in your past, and you tweak the name just a little bit for a character who dies a very horrible death. I mean, that's, you know,
that's one of being an author.
I actually, an upcoming book, I've got a character, and I want to name that character after one of my really good friends in Scotland. And I asked him, I said, I want to use your name in the next book. And he goes, yeah, I love your books. And I said, okay, you want to be a good guy or a bad guy? He goes, oh, I want to be a bad guy. He's
all right,
I'm the bad guy.
You know, it's funny. The book Jim and I did, Last Lonely Trail, I had a gang of 9 men who I wanted everybody to hate. But I wasn't going to sit there and try to come up with 9 names. So I went to, we call it red shirting in the sci-fi realms. Went to a bunch of my author friends and said, okay, I got 9 bad guys. You're all going to die, and it's going to be horrible. It's not going to be pleasant. Do you want me to name them after you? And I had 30 volunteers within an hour. So I'm like, okay, I'm out of names. And then all my female author friends are like, well, what about us? And I'm like, well, women didn't run around, you know, shooting, killing, and looting. You know, best I can do, there's a scene where the saloon, with a saloon madam and her girls, best I could do. And they're like, okay, we're in. My wife jumps in and goes, well, I want to be the madam. So yeah, when you
that would make it pretty hard to write, I would think, if you made her the madam of a prostitution house.
You know, we made it work. I don't know how, but we made it work. The funny one was, there was I think he's about 9 years old. his mom was one of the saloon girls, and she joins forces with the bad guys. And so he reads the book, and he gave me a royal chewing out for making his mom one of the bad guys. So I'm like, your mother volunteered, young man. Go talk to her. yeah, go ahead, Bobby.
Well, gentlemen, I'm looking at our time.
Yeah,
and it is about this time in the evening when we ask the question. And since we have four, well, Russ, you and I are not the writers. So since we have three writers here, Russ, will you ask the question? And JR, will you answer it first? And then we would love to hear Bob and Richard.
All right. Are you ready, JR?
I'm
Hold on to your table. All here right. comes.
A tight grip.
Okay. Have you ever gotten writer's block?
The first book that I did experience writer's block pretty much from word one to the end.
Wow.
Since then, I've sort of changed my attitude toward writer's block. And I really think that what writer's block is a story that writers tell themselves. Because we all tend to be a little bit on the procrastination side and a little bit on the fearful side. We've all got a little bit of imposter syndrome, you know, some of us more than others. But I really think that what most people call writer's block is just sort of a mixture of procrastination and self-indulgence and fear. And I think once you can look at that and see it for that, it sort of goes away.
Hell, I'd make a great writer.
Okay, Bob, you're up.
All right, short answer is no. Never really have. I've thought about it, and I thought back, and even when I was writing in school, in like junior high school and high school, and I still want to slap the one teacher I had who accused me of plagiarism on something I'd never even read. So I never have. I think for me, my mind is kind of always going, and I get my best stories when I'm driving to work or just driving around. And I think because for some reason, the good Lord has blessed me with the ability to look at one little scene and in 5 or 10 minutes come up with a whole book or a whole movie or a whole play, you know, short story or long story. And it's just been that way for me. I've just never had that happen, and hopefully I never will. But I just my mind is constantly moving. And it allows me to, I guess the best way to put it is when I'm writing, and I know other writers do this too, but when I'm writing, I'm picturing a movie scene in my head. And I see all the things that are in that scene, and there's things like the door. Well, if I'm kind of wondering what's next, will the door open and somebody come in or whatever? And that's just the kind of way my mind works. And to go back real quick, I wrote a story about a guy who, I love irony. And I wrote a short story as an assignment in the 8th grade about a guy who was in prison, and he, the day before he was going to break out, he'd saw through the bars and everything. They moved him to another cell, and the guy who got into that cell used his method and got killed. And my teacher gave me an F saying that I plagiarized the Count of Monte Cristo. And I said, the what? And he said, the Count of Monte Cristo. And I said, what's the Count of Monte Cristo? Don't tell me you haven't read it. And I said, I don't know what it is. You know, I had not read it ever up until that time. And I still haven't read it. I've seen the movie, but I haven't read it. And so it almost ended my writing career, but the whatever it is inside me that says, go screw yourself, I'm going to do this anyway, kept me going forward. And, I don't know whatever happened to him, but Mr. Hall, I think was his name, is somewhere off in the ozone somewhere.
There you go. You know, for me, when I was first on this show, I got asked that question, and I said it then. I pretty much made it now, is because of my newspaper background. You're expected to crank out 500 to 1,000 words every day you're on the job, minimum, after having gone out and gathered the information. So you could not afford to get writer's block. If you got writer's block, they got somebody else to do your job, and you went and flipped hamburgers or whatever you could find. So I never did until last year, and it was when my dad passed away. And I got home after dealing with all that, and I had a book that was scheduled to come out in April, and I sat down in front of the computer and nothing was there. Mm-hmm. And it hit me that I was going to have to take some time and get things sorted out. And when I was ready, I would know. And I scared myself because I waited till March 1st to get back and get writing. I got the book done, but God only knows how I pulled that one off. But I think sometimes life does that to you. And it's not really so much writer's block as you have been hammered so hard, you have to get some things sorted out and get it processed, and then you can get back to letting those creative juices flow. So that kind of is my amended answer is I never did until recently. We are getting close to the end, and I do want to thank a few people who have been associated with the show. First, the four of you for being on tonight, thank you for coming and thank you for being a part of this show. It will be the last show for a while. The show is going in hiatus. When it comes back, in what form, those are decisions that will be made in the days and weeks to come. But we will hopefully be back as soon as we can. Thank you, Bobby, for helping getting this started. Russ, for filling in when needed. Bob, for stepping in when I decided to go off to Nebraska. I still have no explanation. JR, thank you for being on tonight. I also want to thank Sam Hassan, who is listening tonight, for creating LA Talk Radio and giving us a place to come to and somehow keeping the lights on during the pandemic so that we can continue doing this show. Sam, there is not enough words that I could put together to convey and even come close to conveying how much we appreciate everything you've done for us. You've been a great friend. You've been a great host. Continue doing this. And thank you so very much. Our first original, or at least for me, engineer was Ronan Rosner. Life has taken him in a different direction. I don't know where. But Ronan, wherever you are out there, my brother, thank you so much for all you did those years you were in the engineer's room. One of these days, Ronan and I need to get together and do a show just on things that happened behind the scenes before we even got on the air. To Jim, thank you, sir, for being a friend. And thank you, Jerry, his wife, for everything you did to keep this show going. All the authors who were guests over the years, thank you for being on. Without you, this show wouldn't be what it was. And I mentioned earlier how many people listen to this show every week. We appreciate you so very much, because if you weren't listening, we wouldn't be having a reason to be here. I knew this part was going to be hard. We are at the part in our journey where we must part paths and go our separate ways. And so I want you to keep this in mind, these words from Tennyson. It may be well, shall we touch the happy isles and see the great Achilles whom we knew. Though much is taken, much abides. And though we are not now, that strength which in old days moved earth and heaven, that which we are. One equal temper of heroic hearts, made weak by time and fate, but strong in will to strive, to seek, to find, and not to yield. This is not goodbye, dear friends, but rather it is until we meet again.
You're listening to Writer's Block with Jim Christina, Bobby Bell, and Richard Polinelli, only on LA Talk Radio.